The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
Welcome to the program. Our guest is Kirsten Morin. She is co-head of Global Venture Capital at Aberdeen, an organization that she joined in 2015. It was actually Flag Capital Management that she was with prior to that. But Flag was acquired by Aberdeen, and as it turns out, Kirsten Morin has been working in the same office since 2005, despite working for two different organizations, actually. And she's been focused on venture capital investing the entire time, so she's played a similar role at both. And prior to joining Flag and then eventually Aberdeen, she worked at IBM in a variety of analytical roles. And she joins us by phone from Stamford, Connecticut. Kirsten Morin, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be joining you today.
Well, you know, venture capital, I've long said that it's probably the sexiest stripe of finance there is out there. There's so many people who I think dream of becoming venture capitalists and having dominion over deals and having access to the kind of deals and making the kind of fortunes that are possible in venture capital, although there are many more failures than successes. We'll talk about that a little bit, that it's the successes have to be big to make up for the losses. It's a bit of a thinking man and thinking woman's gambling casino in a way, although probably not the favorite way to characterize it for people in the business, Kirsten. So let's talk a little bit about what types of companies right now, types of companies and technologies are drawing the most venture capital funding. What's the sweet spot right now for VCs? Where do they especially like to put their money?
You know, I think that at the core of venture capital is the innovation cycle. And frankly, that's what makes venture such an exciting place to be investing right now, because there are such a robust set of technologies being developed. And, you know, some of the categories that I would mention as being the most compelling and where venture capitalists seem to be spending the bulk of their time are in areas like artificial intelligence, machine learning, you know, trying to glean actionable insights from large data sets. There's been a lot of talk about autonomous vehicles and the application of technology to driverless cars and whatnot. And we're also seeing a real uptick in investment behind blockchain-related technologies. So as you think about decentralized networks of the future and, you know, potentially upsetting the power that accretes to some of the large networks, the Facebooks and Amazons of the world, there's a set of entrepreneurs that are trying to think about ways where that power would go back to a community of users, and that's powering blockchain. And we're seeing a lot of entrepreneurs focused on compelling technology and innovations in those sectors, and VCs spending a lot of time looking through their lens and finding opportunities there as well.
You know, there really is so much going on, and you look at the biomedical field as well with things such as gene therapy, and then there's nanotechnology and whatnot. It makes me wonder a little bit about how much money is being committed to venture capital by investors. It's an alternative investment for both individual investors and family offices, as well as institutional investors. Do you see a higher capital flow right now into venture capital funds, or has it been level for several years? What's been kind of the trend these days, just in terms of the amount of venture capital VC firms attract?
Yes, there has been a steady march upwards over the last few years, but I would separate that into two separate distinct buckets. First, if you look at the headline numbers, there was probably close to $40 billion raised by venture capital funds in 2016. And, you know, that has steadily climbed higher over the last several years. But if you dig further into those numbers, what you'll find is that the uptick has really been driven by the growth in later stage, growth stage fundraising as opposed to the early stage. So if you peel back that onion, the early stage funds, the amount of capital that has been raised by those sorts of firms has remained relatively constant and is hovering sub $10 billion year over year, whereas it's really been in the growth arena that we've seen a change, where upwards of $30 billion was raised by managers focused on growth stage investing. And and that doesn't even include SoftBank's $100 billion Vision Fund, which came online last year as well. So we've really seen a pronounced change in the growth end of the market. But, the early stage market, which is where we think the best opportunities lie because of the potential to generate outsized returns, we haven't seen the same, the same steady climb in terms of the dollars raised.
So is there more money in the venture capital, the independent venture capital firms? Do they control more money, or is it the venture arms of these various organizations, everything these days from General Motors to Google? Do you have a sense for that?
Yeah, so I think it's a combination of both. We've seen certainly the entrance of many non-traditional corporate venture investors, and whether it be Google's venture arm or Walmart becoming interested, or many of the auto manufacturers, et cetera, we've seen an uptick of activity there. But we've also seen that really the most established high-profile venture capital firms out there, the franchise firms, if you will, they have a significant amount of control over how much capital they can raise each cycle, and many of them have chosen to steadily march upstream and raise ever larger funds. And, you know, I think it's been a combination of a couple things, where not only have they continued to raise their early stage focused venture capital firms that historically have done well, and it's been, why they've built franchise names for themselves, but many of them have also decided to raise growth companion funds to invest alongside their early stage funds because of the advent of all these non-traditional sources of venture capital. I think many of them feel as though they were handing off their pro rata in their later stage investments to folks who hadn't been involved in driving the company to the achievements that reached it, whatever point it was, and rather than handing that pro rata off to non-traditional investors, they have decided to raise dedicated separate pools of capital to, make those growth investments themselves. So I'd say it's a mix. If I were to try to categorize, where's the influx of capital coming from, I think that many of the non-traditional investors, those corporate VC arms, see the need to incorporate technology into their future product roadmaps. It's the way of the future. All of them have to be thinking about the ways that technology has the potential to disrupt their core businesses, and they need to innovate to stay relevant. And that means that many of them are dipping down into the private markets to look for strategic assets or, products that they can embed into their existing product stack to drive growth in their companies in the future.
Would it be fair to say that more venture capital today is needed than ever because of the ambition of some of the endeavors? And I'll point to one that I think is a real standout. If you think about the space program, back in the day when we were doing the moonshot, the thought of a private company or a private investor getting involved in sending rockets into space and even talking about colonizing planets, like what we're hearing today from people like Elon Musk and or space tourism from Jeff Bezos, you're talking about something that was really kind of unthinkable back decades past. And nowadays, we have private companies and private entrepreneurs moving into spaces that, no pun intended, but really moving into these various endeavors that used to simply be out of reach.
Yeah, so I think that, yes, Certainly, the moonshots, if you will, like a SpaceX, those are capital-intensive companies. And I think in the past, you might have questioned whether it fit the venture model, where folks try to establish product market fit quickly. And, you know, SpaceX is historically been the realm of more project finance and much more established players. But, you know, I think it's a couple things. If you look at SpaceX, yes, that's a company that's raised, you know, nearly $2 billion of funding privately. Facebook raised $5 billion of capital privately before ultimately electing to go public back in 2012. And similarly, Uber has raised billions of dollars as it has built its dominance in the car sharing and ride sharing market. But I think what's changed, there's a couple things that have changed. First of all, it is the availability of growth stage capital, and we just talked about the changes we've seen in that market and the you know, the growth of the many sources of growth stage capital. What that has the impact that has had is that companies are staying private longer. If you look at the time to IPO, the time to M&A, that has extended in recent years. Not so much on M&A, that's still hovering around 5 years, but if you look at the time to IPO, it's 7 or 8 years. And many of these companies are electing to raise massively large rounds of financing from either traditional venture or less traditional venture sources so that they can grow privately outside of the prying public eye, you know, so that they can meet their financial plans and whatnot, and, you know, essentially spend at will to in pursuit of growth before they become public and ultimately have to answer to the analyst group. So, you know, to us, we think that there are larger, more disruptive companies being started today. We think that relates back to the innovation cycle, but we also think that it's just become the norm. Is if you look at the population of unicorns, if you will, you know, there was fewer than a dozen of them 6-7 years ago, and now there's hundreds of unicorns, being those companies with valuations in excess of $1 billion. And I think many of them, first of all, they're selling into much larger total addressable markets, just because venture has gone global and you can distribute software to every corner of the world and build much larger businesses today than you could have in past cycles. But we think a lot of it relates to just the availability of capital and, you know, the fact these companies are electing to stay private longer. And, you know, the one thing I'd add is that for someone like us or any institutional investor, we think it is reason you would want to include venture capital as part of your portfolio allocation, because ultimately, these companies are electing to stay private longer, and the valuation and the value of these companies is accruing to private market investors, whereas in past cycles, these companies would have long ago been public, and the value would have accreted to public market investors. So we think that's a fundamental change in the way that companies are built today, and you know, is further rationale for the inclusion of venture as part of one's allocation.
Well, let's talk about what kind of returns venture capital has you know, yielded for investors. What I don't know what kind of time frame you want to kind of do a snapshot of, Kirsten. What's a fair time frame? But venture capital, can a person investing there can expect to get what kind of returns?
Sure. So, you know, I think I guess venture has seen great periods of great returns and periods where the returns were less than spectacular. And if you rewind history and look at the period in and around the dot-com bubble in the late 90s, early 2000s, investing in venture wasn't a particularly attractive place to deploy capital. You know, the median returns really, there weren't really returns to be had. You had to just be with those top quartile or even probably top decile managers back in those days to get any level of performance from venture capital. And I think that all changed right around 2007. As you look at the advent of the iPhone, when that launched in 2007, we're now 10 years plus into really the shift from desktop to mobile, and I think that has powered a lot of the innovation that we've seen. We've also seen a shift to the cloud. I alluded to it earlier, but you know, being able to deliver software seamlessly over the internet has been a fundamental change that has allowed companies to scale far more rapidly because they don't have to build local sales forces. And I think what that has allowed you to do is you've seen, again, this just very powerful innovation cycle has led to returns. And returns in venture since 2007 have been very strong. You know, I would say that the median return has been somewhere in the vicinity of the mid to high teens. If you look at just the level of returns that we've seen. And, you know, I think that really venture is all about access. And the top quartile returns over that same time period are better yet. So if you look at the 3-year returns, you're looking at kind of mid-teens for venture, 5-year, 15-plus, and 20-year returns even higher than that.
So how has venture capital changed since the bad days when the dot-com bubble burst? Because at that time, one of the things people pointed out is that VC firms were spending a lot of money for firms really funding marketing programs to try to build these firms rather than development of technology and building the infrastructure of these startup companies. To begin with, do you concur that that was going on, and how has venture capital changed since the dot-com bubble burst in such a big way years ago?
Yeah, so capital efficiency reigns today. So there is a vibrant seed community, you know, angel community that is essentially de-risking ideas. And, you know, it costs a lot less today than it did in past cycles to get a company to market. So as you think about a company establishing product market fit, that in the early 2000s would have cost millions. You would have had to build the team, buy the hardware, and build the infrastructure, and it would have taken $3, $4, or $5 million to achieve that before you ultimately could determine if there was a product market fit for whatever product that you were developing. Fast forward to today, and you can build and test a thesis with hundreds of thousands of dollars because you can leverage Amazon's AWS to scale with you. You don't have to buy that expensive hardware at the onset of your company. You, as I mentioned earlier, you don't have to build that local sales force. You can distribute and deliver software over the internet. You know, the developers can leverage open source software to build the code behind the software, if you will. And all that contributes to it just costing a lot less to get a company off the ground. And thus, ideas are much further along by the time they raise true institutional venture capital. And, you know, they are somewhat more de-risked than they were in past cycles. So ultimately what that means is that less capital is going into these companies right up front. And if they don't work, they're much smaller write-offs, whereas in yesteryear, you would have had millions of dollars sunk into a project, and it could have been that binary outcome. Today, you can at least de-risk some things before you put meaningful capital behind any project. So we think that has served to reduce the write-off rates that go along with investing in venture capital, and you know, companies and projects are further along. I think we would say that the environment has changed. So Series A financings and right along the continuum, Series B, Series C, they've all swelled in terms of the round sizes. What used to be a Series A that was, call it, $3 to $5 million now might be as much as $8 to $12 million. But the projects that these managers are backing look a lot different. You know, they have established that product market fit. They may be generating some initial revenues, et cetera, and exhibiting real growth characteristics that, you know, you didn't see in past cycles.
So let's just clarify your role. Are you an analyst? Do you watch the venture capital business and you analyze it, or are you actually involved in the allocation of dollars, Kirsten?
My role is we manage a multi-manager portfolio of funds. So we are a step removed from the company investing, and what we're doing is investing in fund managers who in turn invest in the companies. So we assemble a portfolio of in the vicinity of 15 or so early-stage technology-oriented venture capital fund managers in any given 2 or 3 year period, who then in turn deploy the capital into companies.
I've heard venture capitalists say, I will take a mediocre idea with a great management team any day over a great idea with a mediocre management team. True?
It is beyond true from what we hear from the folks on the front line. So, our job ultimately is to determine who's going to be the first call of entrepreneurs when they're seeking to start a company. And I think as we talk, the managers with whom we work, they say the same, right? They are paying close attention to where the smartest and brightest entrepreneurs are spending their time, and that influences some of the sectors they are focused on. So, when the best and brightest entrepreneur is spending their time looking at machine learning or blockchain decentralized networks, that's where they're going to, focus their time and then calibrate whether that brilliant entrepreneur has a best-in-class idea that could become a larger business, or if there's someone else focused on the same area that has an even better approach that could be successful.
Let's talk about the size of VC rounds, because back when I was paying a lot more attention to venture capital, the opening round might be $1 million, and nowadays when you're talking about the major VC firms on Sand Hill Road, it seems that what's the minimum these days is like $5 million for a first round would be pretty much a minimum. Is that right, Kirsten?
It depends on the stage of focus. There's actually been quite a few new entrants who are focused on pre-seed and seed investing. And for those groups that many of whom have received institutional backing, they could participate in rounds that could range anywhere from 1 to 3 million, where their participation might be somewhere in the $500 to $1 million range. But that group, while many of them have raised institutional capital, I think it is focusing at the most nascent stages of venture capital, where there probably hasn't yet been a product launched into market to establish that fit. For those groups focused on Series A, yes, I think we have seen the round sizes swell. There's many people who would say that Series A investing is what Series B used to be, and right up the continuum where Series B rounds now are what Series C rounds used to be, et cetera. So we have seen a real change to the amount of capital that's being deployed in these rounds, and I think that goes back to the fund size escalation. As venture capital fund managers manage ever larger pools of capital, it's more efficient for them to cut larger checks. If they're going to devote their time to working alongside these entrepreneurs on these projects, it's more efficient for them if they can only take, call it, 6 to 8 board seats in any given fund. It's better for them to write a larger check into those companies where they're going to be spending their time as opposed to, a plethora of much smaller checks.
So there's, of course, the all-important liquidity event. At some point, a VC wants to see the big payoff, and you were talking a little bit earlier about IPOs and M&As. Now, IPOs have fallen off a lot because it's, well, some new regulations around it. It's gotten very expensive to go public. It also seems that a lot of people just feel way too constrained by the public market when you got shareholders standing on your head and you're trying to make some bold decisions. M&As have been pretty brisk, though. What about just the whole liquidity event thing. You were talking about there's a longer timeline these days, are willing to accept a longer timeline. IPOs, I think, have been ticking up. Do you expect IPOs to make a real comeback? And just with M&As, I mean, there was a period of time when M&As was declared empire building. Obviously, it sure seems like the market's much more disciplined than it used to be. What about the whole, all the factors that go into deciding when a liquidity event really makes sense?
Yeah, it's a great question and one that is, very close to our hearts because we're very focused on this. The fact of the matter is that the duration in venture has extended. So the time frames that VCs are holding their companies and the time it's taking these companies to reach an exit has extended. But there's hope. And, I would draw your attention to the fact that, M&A activity has been reasonably strong. And what's more, we actually think that there's an expanded M&A acquirer universe, and that's really important. So whereas there was a set of 5 to 7 active acquirers in past cycles, and it was, the large technology incumbents, the IBM, Cisco's, Oracle's of the world, that buyer universe has changed dramatically over the course of the last 5 to 10 years. And it's not just that there's more technology companies that are active acquirers of these venture-backed companies, but there are non-technology companies who have become highly acquisitive. If you look at someone like a Walmart, they are active buyers of venture-backed companies. John Deere even got in the act last year with an acquisition. And, again, any corporate needs to be thinking about technology as part of their product roadmap to drive growth in the future. And many of them don't have the R&D capabilities to do it in-house, and so they look for promising startups that they can acquire and incorporate into their product set as the path to the future. So that's really exciting to us. We've also seen another path to exit, which is private equity buyers. There's a number of groups who, private equity firms, who have become very active acquirers of technology-related startups, and that's great news for venture-backed companies because it's just another channel through which they can exit. And I would say that on the IPO side, there's hope. We are in an environment where there are a host of maturing companies that are generating real revenues, and I'm talking about hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars of revenues that are certainly mature enough to go public. And, they've chosen not to because of the availability of a glut of growth capital over the last many years, but we think that's changing, and there's signs that that's changing in 2018. As you look at some of the early activity we've seen in the first few months here, Spotify's direct listing with a $24 billion market cap, Dropbox went public with nearly a $10 billion market cap, DocuSign just went public with $4 billion. I could tick through the list. Just last week, Carbon Black was another company with a very successful IPO. So we're seeing evidence that the market is highly receptive to these strong growth technology related companies, and that gives us hope that the volume of IPOs is only going to climb throughout the course of 2018, and it'll be a fertile time to be harvesting some of these more mature investments.
So generally speaking, would you say that venture capital firms and venture capital arms of corporations, are they taking bigger or smaller risks these days, or has it just been level? Because it seems like some of these areas are pretty speculative, maybe even blue sky.
Yes. Yeah. So, I think the obvious point or the obvious area to look at here would be around autonomous driving. And, I think that many people viewed that to be highly speculative, but I think the technology is maturing much quicker than people anticipate that, or ever anticipated that it might. And I think there's a few reasons for that. One of them is that many of these ideas have just become more lightweight solutions where you don't have to develop an entire car, but it can just be, something that is embedded into a post-market car that then can allow these autonomous capabilities. And, you know, I think while, yes, it is risky, and certainly the when there's been a limited number of accidents, it's been prone to grab an outsized portion of the headlines. We think that many of these companies have been successfully testing their technologies for many years now without a lot of notice. And, you know, I think they'll be in market in a more mainstream fashion sooner. Similarly, I think as you look at something as speculative as space exploration, SpaceX has achieved great success with some of their launches, and that business continues to scale. We're seeing a lot of activity in satellites, as an example, and the cost to get those satellites launched has fallen dramatically. So what would have cost some of the space exploration corporations many millions of dollars is now, those costs have fallen sub-million dollars. So again, I think just capital efficiency reigns, as I said earlier, and so what had been the realm of frontier investing or investing on the edge of what folks believed was humanly possible is within reach, because you can test many of these theses with very little capital these days.
Now, venture capital has been really a uniquely American sort of form of finance in company development, although I believe that other countries have caught on. They've seen the great things that we've been able to accomplish with that and are developing their own venture capital industries. And then there's also the U.S. VCs thinking in terms of not just American companies, but maybe looking at the brilliant developments being made in places like Israel and China, perhaps India. Do you see more VC money going abroad, American VC money going abroad, or is that a problem of not having people on the ground, not having perhaps the, as they say, boots on the ground and feeling connected enough to the people there who are running these startup companies, or is that not the case? Do you see more VC dollars flowing overseas?
Yeah, so I think the idea of U.S. VCs raising affiliate funds took hold probably beginning about in a decade ago when folks realized the opportunities were expanding. And, you know, I think specifically people recognized just the massive market in Asia and China specifically, and the rise of the middle class and the unserved population, where if technology could penetrate those markets, that there was the potential to create these massively large companies. And so we started to see US VCs partner with some local affiliates there. I think that market has matured, and today we see fewer affiliate firms and more local capital. But that's not to say that we don't see ever-expanding interest in Asia. I think I'd point specifically to Sequoia's efforts right now to raise a global growth fund with remarkable magnitude that they have said will target a significant number of opportunities in that region. And, you know, obviously, SoftBank's Vision Fund is quite active in that region as well. So we think that you know, there are opportunities in venture outside the U.S. You mentioned Israel. Most multinational corporations have large R&D facilities in Israel. It's a region where deep technology is front and center, and it's a strong engineering community, and we do see a lot of companies particularly get their start in Israel on the developer front and then expand into the U.S. So there's a number of U.S.-based firms who have a local presence in Israel or a partner on the ground in Israel that's investing capital there. We think European venture has improved. That wasn't particularly compelling in our view a decade ago, but it's a maturing ecosystem where, you're seeing far more companies have success, and there being some very strong outcomes in that market as well. So, you know, we think that venture has gone global and that there's pockets of opportunity across the globe for VCs to pursue.
So let's wrap this up by my asking you what single technology, if you could, identify a single technology that excites you the most, that you think is the greatest opportunity. It might be the greatest investment opportunity, or maybe just the greatest opportunity for its impact on humanity. What would you say, Kristen?
So, you know, I think there's many areas that are receiving investment dollars today that are creating compelling technologies, but I think what is the most interesting area that I am seeing the VCs that we're working with explore right now is blockchain. And I would separate the crypto craze over the fourth quarter of last year, where you saw the run-up of Bitcoin and Ethereum and related cryptocurrencies. That, to me, was principally speculative, and I would distinguish that from the underlying fundamental blockchain technologies that are being developed. As you think about a world where, you know, most of what we have done, what we do, has moved online, blockchain technologies have the potential to be fundamentally transformative to the way that we operate online. And as you think about assets being digitized and how you create proof of ownership, if you will. And, you know, I think blockchain has the power to do that by building these decentralized networks where you can prove authenticate and verify the existence of digital assets. And I think that's a compelling use case. I also think that, you know, some of these networks today, like the Facebooks and the Googles of the world, Amazon, have remarkable network power. And, you know, I think there's some belief that blockchain has the potential to decentralize the power that accretes to networks like the ones I just mentioned to disrupt them. And that, to me, could be fundamentally transformative. And if some of these blockchain companies and the entrepreneurs working on the technologies powering them are successful, you know, I think it could be fundamentally transformative to technology markets over time.
Yeah, it's a shame that blockchain is so associated with Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies, because, as you're indicating, blockchain has virtually endless applications that could make the world a better place in a whole lot of different ways. Our guest has been Kristen Morin. She is co-head of Global Venture Capital at Aberdeen. Kristen, really interesting stuff. Thank you for taking the time to get us updated on the world of venture capital. It's an interesting space.
Thank you so very much for having me. I truly enjoyed being your guest today.